Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm delighted now to be joined by one of our greatest living authors, Claire Keegan. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
And you're going to talk us through your life in five songs today. But we might pause first to reflect on what's been an amazing few years for you. So, firstly, your book Small Things Like These was a sensation, made into a terrific film with Cillian Murphy. It was recently voted the best Irish book of the 21st century by the Irish Times. And 3.5 years on since publication, still on the bestseller lists. Are you enjoying the success of it?
I surely am.
Yeah?
Yeah, I have no mixed feelings about it at all. It's great. It's great to have so many readers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you enjoying about it?
I suppose it's the opposite of what I grew up with. I grew up in a place where women weren't heard. And some of the songs I think I've chosen are connected to that. And it's just lovely to have millions of readers.
Yeah. Why do you think this story struck a chord right now, given that there probably was a sense in the country that we had dealt with that story or digested it in some way, had periodic fits of outrage and everything, but suddenly this brought it all back alive in a very visceral way for people?
I think I didn't meet the subject matter head on. It wasn't such a collision, and that was attractive. It was told from the point of view of a kind man who was a good father. I didn't take readers in to the laundries at all very much. And I was asking a question of our society in our recent past as to why this happened and why people didn't do more. And Emily Dickinson has a line, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. And I think you have to go kind of slant ways. You know, I'm really interested in horses and horsemanship. And one of the things that horses know is that a predator makes a straight line for you. And I think I dislike straight line writing. I like factual writing. I like clear writing. But I don't think you can go head on at the subject matter. I think you have to make an arc into it, and that's more a more elegant way of looking at it and presenting it. I like to think that it also had the fact that it was people took pleasure in it because it was well written.
Yeah, absolutely.
People like what is well written and not too long.
I think so, yeah. Who knew? It's interesting you say there about what we might call the possibility of kindness in that situation, because somebody who was a child of a mother and baby home said to me that a lot of the children of the mother and baby homes were delighted at this story being told this way, because for them, the possibility that there was kindness there was really important to them and made them feel much better about things.
Well, that's a terribly sad thing to think about, that there were girls locked up by people who were their closest relatives and people who were meant to be good Christians in the Catholic Church, feeling hopeless because they didn't think there was any kindness out there and knew little or none of it inside and were incarcerated. It's worth thinking about.
Yeah. And then the film adaptation of your novel Foster on Colleen Kuhn, prior to the recent explosion of Small Things Like These, was a huge hit and a real beautiful little gem of a film, Oscar nominated. Kind of, it has become a beloved film now. Was that all very exciting too?
No, I didn't get excited over the films. I don't believe I have a career.
Yeah.
I just have a life, which is a different thing. I think career, the word career, comes from the Latin carus, meaning a wheeled vehicle. It has something to do with being faster or getting there first, or being involved in some kind of a race. And I'm not racing against anyone. There is no race as far as I'm concerned with literature. It's got nothing to do with that. It's not a competition.
But what is it like to sit in a cinema for the first time and see a film of your book?
I'd rather you ask me something else.
Okay. Can you not describe it?
It's not that I can't describe it. It's just that I'd rather answer another question.
Okay. So, before we get to music, can I ask you one other question about all that? It's interesting what you say about career, and sometimes I think that success like you've had can buy a writer some space too and get them off a kind of a treadmill. Did it change your life?
I don't think it's changed me at all, really. I still like doing the things I like to do before all this happened and continue to do them. I certainly don't need to teach anymore, you know, for an income, but I love teaching and I can't give it up. It's a lovely thing to be doing.
What do you get out of it?
Oh, so many things. Just looking at text closely, getting to meet new people, discussing literature, teaching people who've been given what I think is very bad advice, what I think is very good advice,
okay,
on writing, and helping people to be able to write down what it is that they're trying to discover and looking for and to structure it and put a shape on it. But I mean, I still have, you know, I still live in the countryside. I have horses. I travel. I write. It hasn't changed how I write. It hasn't changed how I read or anything. Very much about the day. I had a good life before this.
Yeah, and this didn't ruin it.
No.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Okay, so music then. Tell me about your first music choice today. It's Delia Murphy and Three Lovely Lassies. So where does this bring you back to?
It takes me back to my mother. My mother was born in 1926 and she was the second of three girls in that family. And she loved music and she loved set dancing. And I remember asking her one day, I was frustrated with my father and said, "Why did you marry him?" And she turned around to me and she said, "I married him because he could swing on a threepenny bit." But she and I had a very similar sense of humour.
Yeah.
And we loved Delia Murphy's voice. And I remember, this is a waltz, and I remember her teaching me to waltz with this song on the radio. And I was actually standing on her feet. I was so small and I was getting the rhythm of the waltz through that. But she always laughed, you know, when that word is repeated the fourth time, because it always feels like it should be repeated and you'll hear it, you know, there are three lovely lassies in Banyan, 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 Banyan. You think it's going to stop there, but it goes again and there's another one in it. And we always thought that was hilarious. And I think that our understanding of language is linked to rhythm, I'm sure of it, and meaning is linked to rhythm. And perhaps this is where all of that started for me, standing on my mother's feet, waltzing to Delia Murphy and the Three Lovely Lassies in Banyan.
Okay, here's Claire Keegan's first choice today.
There are three lovely lassies in Banyan, 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 Banyan.
Delia Murphy, Three Lovely Lassies, and that is the writer Claire Keegan's first music choice today. Did your parents continue dancing?
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
They continued dancing and we used to go to Cayley's a lot. And there was a pub in Shillelagh called Taylor's, and they used to have all these great bands, you know, and they'd have Joe Dolan and Roly Daniels and the Indians, and you know, my mother and father, my mother would just go and dance all night. And you'd be sweating. I mean, the clothes would be stuck to you and you have to go out in the freezing cold between the dances just to cool off. You know, you'd lift your skirt to let the icy yeah. wind go under you and you'd go back in again. You'd sweat all night the way, you know, people go to the gym now.
So was the dancing, do you think, the basis of their relationship beyond it being the initial spur for it? Like, did that, did the dancing keep them going in a way, yeah?
I'm sure it did. It was what we got the... They used to get the local paper.
Yeah.
And the first thing you'd look at was what was on. What was on, where would there be a dance at the weekend? And, of course, I was the youngest of six children. I grew up on a farm. And, you know, I wasn't really supposed to be going into those places, but there was nobody to mind me at home. So they took me and I was big for my age. Kind of didn't grow much after I went to secondary school. So I looked older than I was and I was able to kind of slip in.
The lot of you off there. So you were a close family then, were you?
No, we weren't a close family. And my sisters were in boarding school. Like my eldest sister is 17 years older than me. So she was finished secondary school before I was born. And then my other sister had gone to London straight after leaving boarding school. So I never really knew her. So we weren't a close family.
So were you half an only child then by the time you came along?
Half an only child? What is that?
That's not actually technically an only child, but kind of an only child.
Okay, I thought it was, I don't get out much really, and I thought it might
be a term. No, sorry, I'm not as precision and clear a talker as you are probably.
No, not at all. I didn't feel like an only child because my brothers were at home and I have three brothers.
Okay.
So they came and went and my brother Jim was there and he had horses and then my other brothers, you know, they were all older than me. So I didn't feel that way.
Did you like growing up on the farm?
I did very much. I loved having a pony and going through the wood. I used to imagine that I was a Native American Indian girl. I had two long plaits and a skew ball pony and I rode bareback. And I just thought that that was the thing to be, you know. I liked the cattle. My mother had pigs. I was reared on pig money. Yeah. And I loved pigs. And I'm actually putting pigs into a book I'm working on at the moment. But I like the
Why
sheep too.
Why do you love
too.
Pigs?
Oh, God. How long do you have? I think they're delightful. They're born with full personalities. I don't know if you've seen a litter of bonds, but if you've a litter of bonds, they just come out with their personalities intact. So there's the sleepy one and there's the big one who wants to suck two tits. And there's the one that's so pretty, she knows she's pretty. And there's the one that's shy and wants to hide. And they're all delightful. And they're so clean. They make their dung at the opposite end of where they sleep. And they used to, my mother used to let the sows out into the orchard. We had an old orchard at the back of the house. And there was a stream in it. And they'd go and they'd rub themselves against the trees and the apples and pears would fall down and they'd eat them. And then they'd go and lie in the stream and then roll in the clay. So it was like a whole spa thing for the pigs, you know, because the clay would fall off then. And they were just clean and delightful. And my mother made good money out of them and sent me to school, bought my school books and my school uniform from the litter.
Were there books in the house growing up?
No, we didn't have books. We didn't have any money to spare. There was a Bible, nobody read, but I used to go down, I still have it, and I used to go down and look at all the pictures, and I now realise they're masterpieces, but they used to be frightening to me, you know, and St. John the Baptist and... You know, a head on a plate and Lazarus rising up in a tomb and people jeering Christ on the cross and nailing his hands to the wooden cross and all of that. I still think it may be the most adult book I've ever seen. But we didn't read it and we weren't an overly pious family. And my mother used to buy me Ladybird books every now and then as a treat. I'd get a Ladybird book too. to bring home, and that was cherished.
Yeah, and they were short too.
But they were long enough when I was that age.
Your next choice is the Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays, but specifically the performance from Live Aid.
Well, that was 1985, and I was a teenager. I was probably the same age as the girl Geldof is singing about. And I felt that the 80s were desolate and hopeless to some extent. Right. So much unemployment, troubles in the north. You wondered what would become of you. What would happen after you left school? What was there out there for you? Were you supposed to just get married and have children and live in a semi-poverty? And I didn't like secondary school. I really didn't like secondary school. And I had loved National School. I used to just be dying to go back in September. I thought it was great. And I went into Tullow Community School then. And kind of the bottom fell out of my life, and school, it used to be something I used to just love doing. And I'd have all my copybooks covered in wallpaper and be ready. I just dreaded Mondays. And so I connected with the words, you know, of the song I Don't Like Mondays. But also, I really liked Bob Geldof because he was somebody you couldn't shut up.
Yeah.
He was out there, and I think they called him, and perhaps still call him, Big Mouth. You couldn't shut him up. And I remember reading Is That It?
Yeah.
His biography when I came back in the 90s. I came back in 92, I think it was out about then. And I just loved what he had to say about feeling that he had to get out of Ireland to be successful.
Yeah.
And I liked that. Ironically, I wound up living in the house he grew up in Dunleary when I was studying at Trinity. I rented a bedsit there, and his father was my landlord. So it's funny how things come around.
What was he like?
He looked very much like his son.
Yeah. Come here. You can't overstate for people who grew up in the 80s how important Geldof was for us in terms of the things he was saying and everything else, because there had been no one like that really for us before that. Sure, there hadn't, like, and he was kicking it all down, like.
Yes, I liked that very, very much about him. But when that moment came in Live Aid, and I wasn't there, I was only watching it on the television. When that moment came, when he said, and the lesson today is how to die, then the music stopped and the crowd really did go wild. People say that, but that was actually the crowd going wild because it meant something. He had accomplished something. Also, he came out on stage. He hadn't even changed, never even thought about changing his clothes or doing anything with himself. And it didn't matter what he looked like. It didn't matter the presentation. That type of vanity didn't matter. What he was doing mattered.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that pushed open a door.
Okay, so here's Claire Keegan's second choice. This is I Don't Like Mondays from Live Aid.
And we can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to die? Oh, when the silicon chip inside your head gets sweet.
Shivers, isn't it? Shivers, incredible, yeah. Well picked, good choice. The year after that Live Aid performance, you were 17 and you moved to New Orleans then. How did that happen?
I met a family when I was 16. They were a wealthy family who came over to Wexford with several of their friends and relatives, and they advertised in the local paper for somebody to cook breakfast for them and then have dinner ready for them when they came back after touring around for the day. And so I applied for that job, and they gave me that job. And then when they were leaving, they said, would you like to come and live in the United States when you're finished high school? And I said, yes. And so I went to New Orleans in 1986. I was still 17 at that time.
It must have been amazing to be whisked away from your family and everything you knew and all that at that age. Was it good for you?
It was mixed. Most things are mixed. I didn't feel safe in New Orleans. It's still one of the most dangerous cities in the world. I thought it was racist. I didn't think it would be so misogynistic. I didn't think it would be as backward as it is. And I couldn't get over the climate. I just couldn't get over the first night. I could not get over the fact that you went outside and it was still hot. I had never experienced that before. And I wondered what I had done to myself. That night, I just wondered, how am I going to enjoy my life outside here? But I went to Loyola University, and I really loved that. I loved going to university, so I liked reading, and a library card was as good as a credit card to me.
So had you been very sheltered before that as well? And then you're thrown into this very different, frightening situation.
I don't know that I was sheltered. Sheltered implies that I felt secure. And I don't believe that I felt secure in the 80s in Ireland. No, I didn't feel that. I didn't feel that in my family life either. But I certainly was inexperienced.
Okay, we'll come back to New Orleans. Why didn't you feel secure in Ireland in the 80s? Is that back to the misogyny?
Yes, and your future, your income, the unemployment, you just didn't have a feeling for the future holding that which was promising.
Yeah. So your next choice is American, Joni Mitchell, California. Is this the music you started discovering then when you went to America, yeah?
Yes, when I went to the house, they lived in a suburb outside of New Orleans near the country club. And I thought there'd be a whole lot of books, and there were hardly any books. The woman of that house had a daughter from a previous marriage who was 3 or 4 years younger than me. She used to read fantasy books, but I wasn't really interested in those. I really liked realism. But they had records, and there was about, I don't know, a dozen records, maybe 2 dozen, but I don't think so. Also, I was kind of shocked that they didn't have more records than we did, because we had no money, you know. But one of the records was Joni Mitchell's Blue, which I still think is the most wonderful album. And the first song, I put it on and I didn't know if I would be allowed to play music in the house. But I put that record on and it was side two. And the first Joni Mitchell song I ever heard was California. And I'd never heard anything like that. And there is nobody like her. There are people who try to be like her, but there is nobody like Joni Mitchell. And California was connected up to a book I had found behind the records. And the book was about Charles Manson. You know, it was a factual, mm-hmm. you know, it was about this dreadful gang who was led by a murderer, and he had killed Roman Polanski's wife, who was pregnant, heavily pregnant at the time, Sharon Tate. And so I got this feeling again that this was a dangerous place to be. I had never read anything like that in my life. And then and that all happened in California. And then Joni Mitchell comes on the record player singing about California. And I don't know that I would have slept very easily that night.
Okay, here's Claire Keegan's third choice, Joni Mitchell, California.
Coming home, I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset peak, California, I'm coming home.
That's Joni Mitchell, California. That's Claire Keegan's third music choice today. Claire, I only read your earlier short stories recently. And if people haven't read them, some of them are very different in tone and setting from what they might expect from you. And some of them are in that tradition, I think, of that darkness of the of the south of America. You clearly found there was a darkness there, yeah?
Surely there was. I mean, the whole economy was based on slavery.
Yeah.
And repression and violence.
And that was still resonating by the time you got there?
Without a doubt. Yes, it was there all the time. Yeah.
And that brings us probably to your next choice, which is Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. Tell me why you chose this. And you might explain to people as well who don't know what the Strange Fruit is.
Strange Fruit is a song, I think it's based on a 1930s. It was written in the 1930s, I think. And it's about the lynchings of the people in the South, most of whom were black. And lynchings are public hangings without due process. So I went into the Loyola University Library, and I didn't know there was a music library with all these albums. And I really wanted to listen to the music of the South. I really wanted to listen to jazz and educate myself that way, because I wasn't studying music, but I did take a music course, a history of music course, which is great. So I used to go in and listen to records in the library there. But I do remember taking out this album and listening to Strange Fruit and feeling chilled by it, and knowing it was about the public lynchings, which were, you know, they were forms of entertainment for white racist people in the South. There's a wonderful story by James Baldwin. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's called Going to Meet the Man. And it's told from the point of view of a sheriff who's lying in bed on a hot night with his wife. And there are people down in the background singing. And all he wants to do is shut them up. And he has shut them up in prison, and he's beaten them up in prison. But they're singing now. And they're gathering together, and they're gathering power, and they're singing. And he's trying to get an erection and can't. And his wife says, you know, oh, so right, honey. And, you know, I think she probably has a fair idea that what she's missing isn't very much. And what you go into then, and it's told in his point of view, what you go into then is a memory this sheriff has of going to a lynching with his parents for entertainment, and how his father put him up on his shoulders so he could get a good view. And so when I put that story with Billie Holiday's voice singing Strange Fruit, I never looked at the trees. There are all these oak trees across St. Charles Avenue from where I was studying in Audubon Park. Beautiful old trees. But I never looked at them the same way again after hearing this.
In the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
That's Billie Holiday there in Strange Fruit, and that's Claire Keegan's fourth choice today. And she never looked at the trees the same way again after that. So, Claire, are you working on a new book?
I am. I'm working on a book. I'm taking notes for a book. I haven't really got anything on a screen.
I'm not putting pressure on you or anything. I feel like somebody's mother. Are you working on a book or what?
And it's set on the farm where I grew up, on the Wicklow-Wexford-Carlow border. I usually make up what goes inside of a book, but I often use a place I've lived in or stayed in as the setting for the book, and it's kind of like the bowl that I put everything into. So I've wanted to write a book set on the farm, and now feels like the right time to do it.
Did you have to go back to the farm eventually, yeah?
No, I think I chose to.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it nice going back to it?
Oh, it is, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I like the place very much. I like looking out over Mount Leinster and the fields, and it's high up, and there were old trees and a forest all around it, and a lane. It was a very old house. It was actually an old three-storey house that was built in the 1700s, and the house and the 50 acres around it were given to my mother and father when they married by the Land Commission.
All right,
and,
yeah.
And that's why there was an old orchard and old stables and barns and everything in it, you know. But my father actually tore down most of the three-storey house with the old paddy horse, stone by stone, because they wouldn't have been able to afford the rates on it.
Right.
But it was in a lovely place and a good place to grow up.
Is it still there and still in the family?
Yes. My brother sold it during the boom, but I don't. Yes, it's still there.
Yeah, but not for you to go back to any time you want.
Well, I don't know. I haven't actually contacted the people there and asked them if I could do that.
Okay. Your final choice is by Nina Simone. But before we play it, there is something else you picked out. Kind of a snippet of Nina Simone that is important to you. Explain to me about this.
Well, this is at the beginning of a recording. And, you know, she believes that all of her music comes from the African drum. That's what she feels. That's what she felt. And so when this track, the recording began, she says, you're pushing it. It'll go up by itself. Don't put nothing in it unless you feel it. Let's do it again, please. And when I heard that, I thought, what wonderful advice for writers. You don't push it. You know, it'll go up by itself. You don't force it. And then you do it again, which means you rewrite it. And so it's something I play for. It's something I play for my students. And I just thought I'd include it here before the actual track.
Okay. So does it come then? Do you have to get out of the way of it? And it comes? You can't force it, no?
Yeah, I don't believe in plot. I don't believe in forcing it. I think you listen to it and you wait on it. And you wait for it. You're in its service rather than manipulating it in a forceful way.
And does it reveal itself then?
I think to some extent it does.
And why to you? Why does it reveal itself to you?
Well, I don't know, but I think some stories just want to be Clare Keegan stories.
Yeah.
And some stories want to be Stephen King or Roddy Doyle or Elizabeth Bishop poems or whatever it is. It's funny, you know, I have a cat and I never knew much about cats and still don't. But during lockdown, this cat came out of the bushes to me one night. I was standing outside of my front door with my brother and sister-in-law. And the cat a ginger cat ran out of the bushes and came up to me and decided that he was going to live with me. And he lives with me now, still. He was very young. And I think stories are a bit like that. I think they choose you and that maybe we have less to do with them than we believe we do. That story is almost like pre-existing and then it's waiting patiently on you to find the words and discover it, to take the cover off and find it.
Okay, so before we go to the last piece of music, here's the little clip from Nina Simone.
Y'all pushing it. Just relax. You're pushing it. It'll go up by itself. Don't put nothing in it unless you feel it. Let's do it again, please.
That's life there in a nutshell, isn't it? Like no forcing, no holding back, just let it go. Okay. So then your final actual choice is African Mailman by Nina Simone. Why this?
I think it's delightful and energetic and lively and irrefutably beautiful. And if it was a piece of prose, I think it'd be a masterpiece as a piece of prose. There's something in it it just delights me. And when it ends, you don't want it to end. And then you know it's over. And you know that it's over and it was just enough. And I think elegance is just enough. It's about saying just enough, about playing just enough, and the energy in it and the liveliness. It just delights me. It just makes me happy.
Okay. And listen, you have delighted us and made us happy. You're a most beautiful, mesmerising, such a clear, expressive, fantastic talker. Because, you know, the way sometimes people can write like angels, but then they're not so great when they have to just talk it out on the spot. But that was stunning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we play out on your final song, Nina Simone's African Mailman. Claire Keegan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan.